Accession number 30392, reel 2.
What then happened when you were aboard Mare?
Aboard Mare? Well, this was part of the 4th destroyer flotilla, which consisted of HMS Cossack, HMS... Oh, yeah. Yes, HMS Cossack. I beg your pardon. You see, that's... I hope to cut the tape off of that. HMS Cossack, with Captain Vian in charge of the 4th destroyer flotilla, Cossack, Mare, Zulu, and Sikh. And, as I've said on that tape, Vian was a legendary figure. He was, you know, a huge reputation. And he'd taken the Cossack on its own, or with the destroyer, I forget now, into a Norwegian fjord, when this was after the Germans had occupied Norway, where there was a German merchantman moored, which had a lot of British, not naval, but marine sailors prisoner aboard. And he went in there and rescued them, boarded them. And he was quite a character. And we were doing not Arctic convoys. Not then, I can't remember now. Anyhow, in those early days, we were doing Atlantic convoy work, all 4 destroyers. And then the Bismarck broke out of the North Sea up to Iceland, engaged by one of the new battleships. I'm not sure if it was KG5, King George V, or the Prince of Wales, and the Hood. And the Hood was sunk. That terrible thing whereby it is understood that it was hit by a salvo from the Bismarck, and one of the shells had penetrated the what do you call an ammunition store? I'm sorry.
Magazine,
thank you very much. One of the magazines, and the thing blew. And there were, I think, 5 survivors from Hood. Anyhow, the other battleship was told to get the hell out of it and not engage Bismarck alone. And Bismarck was therefore out alone in the Atlantic, able, and all our Atlantic convoys were extremely vulnerable. And so we were all sent off searching for her. And eventually, an RAF Catalina sighted her, reported back. The story goes, I don't know, that they got the position 150 miles out. But anyhow, it was sighted, and our forces began to be focused on that. And a carrier, I don't know what, came up from Gibraltar from the Mediterranean with Swordfish, and their recce found Bismarck. And they launched a Swordfish torpedo attack. But they made a terrible, error, and the Swordfish went to attack a British cruiser, whose name I don't know. But luckily, the Swordfish were fitted with the torpedoes were fitted with these new magnetic heads, and there was such a swell that the torpedoes going up and down like that, and that actually detonated the magnetic heads before they hit the British cruiser. So they got back in and carried out another attack. I don't know if it was the same day or next day or something. Swordfish torpedo attack on the Bismarck. And this was the Bismarck, and they hit it. And by a wonderful stroke of luck, one of the torpedoes hit the rudder and jammed it. And the Bismarck was therefore completely incapacitated. He couldn't steer. He was out of action. From that point of view, couldn't steer, and, you know, and we were then honed in and told where the Bismarck was, and we were the closest people to it. And now this is again where my memory is a bit vague. There were 4 of us destroyers, but one of them was a Polish destroyer, HMS, well, I wouldn't call it HMS, was Polish destroyer Piorun, P-I-O-R-U-N. So either Sikh or Zulu wasn't there. And there were 4 of us,
and we went right round the Bismarck at dusk, at night, and shadowed her from, you know, four quarters all around her. And, you know, we fired star shells to light her up. She fired star shells back at us. And vaguely, the destroyers carried out odd torpedo attacks during the night. And we in Mare carried out torpedo attack just before dawn, or just, you know, first light. And I don't know whether we hit her. I can't remember. I don't think we did. I don't know. Nobody knows. And then the British fleet hove in sight and engaged the Bismarck. And this British fleet was HMS Rodney, a cruiser, the Dorsetshire, and another cruiser, I think. And I think that battleship, KG-5 class, that had left her in Iceland. Anyhow, there were two battleships, I'm sure. And they hammered away at Bismarck. Bismarck, having been entirely successful and completely uninjured till then, now failed to even hit a single one of the British ships and was herself battered into absolute shambles. And the signal came out that Bismarck was totally destroyed, but we couldn't sink her by gunfire. Would somebody please go in and torpedo her? And I don't know who somebody did. They went in and torpedoed her and sank her. As I've said, doing research since then in this, the crew of the Bismarck was 2,200. This was May the 24th, I think it was, 1941. And they reckon that 800 Germans survived and got into the sea. And Dorsetshire and us in the Mare stopped and were picking up survivors. There is a photograph, goodness knows how it was taken from, of Dorsetshire with ropes hanging over the side and German sailors tying themselves into ropes and being hauled up. But also I know that the Dorsetshire also managed to lower her gangplank. Forgive me, but do your family have any naval connections? Dorsetshire was stopped, and we were stopped. We threw a scrambling net over the side. You know, it's about a 15-foot rope net with squares about a foot square, I suppose, and the German sailors could get into this and climb up it, and we took them aboard. I don't know exactly how many we got. I think it was 24, 25, 26, something like that, some mid-20s number. And the signal came through that a U-boat was or might be in the vicinity. So Dorsetshire and Mare, we went off at full speed to get the hell out of it. And when we did, there was one German in the net who'd hooked his arm over into the net, and we were doing, well, we could do 34 knots, we were probably doing the best part of that, and the flow of water, so he couldn't climb up it. And I was there as a midshipman, and we had about, I don't know, 12 dozen sailors there. We tried to pull the net up, we couldn't pull it up against the flow of that water. So I ran up onto the bridge to our captain, Commander Big E Armstrong. Oh, a superman. He was called Big E because of his nose, and he used to play centre three-quarter for the Royal Naval rugby team. And I said to him that there was this one German in the net, could we stop for just 2 minutes to get him up? And he understandably said, nope, U-boat in the vicinity, I can't put the ship at risk. Well, you don't know what he said. Anyhow, he said no. So I went down again, and there was this German in full naval uniform, full blue officer's uniform, with a massive gold braid over one shoulder, and a very lean face, grey, sunken face, you know, the skin pulled very tight over his skull bones. And we tried and tried to pull him up, and he couldn't come up. So I gave the order, and we cut the next adrift. Cut him adrift. And we left 800 German sailors to dry. Which is hideous. Anyhow, we then headed back to the UK. This was all in way out in the Bay of Biscay, I suppose, quite a way out from France. I remember we had to refuel on the way back because, you know, we'd exhausted our fuel supplies all the way. And we went back, got back into Greenock, and going to put the 25, whatever it was, German prisoners ashore. The army came to collect them. And there was a gangplank down, and they had to walk down the gangplank. And nothing brutal, but the soldiers hustled those German prisoners down with the butts of their rifles, you know. Just unnecessary. And our sailors, who'd picked up the German sailors, put a stop to that. Quite rightly. And then, Mari, I suppose we resumed. And this is, you see, where I get completely confused. Because I know that I was in Mari in the Mediterranean at some time. So presumably we took convoys down around out south and into the Mediterranean. Because I remember taking convoys with Mari from Gibraltar through to Malta, and being in Malta at times in Mari too. And on one occasion, when there was a convoy coming through and we were in Malta, we were sent up to create a diversion, and we went up overnight to bombard a port on the west coast of Sardinia. And we got up there, and I don't know, sometime in the middle of the night, two destroyers, I think Mari and one of the others, Sikh or Zulu, I don't know. And we fired star shells, and all we could see was this great big hill rising up out of the sea, and there was a sort of funny little house on top. It was probably a coast guard's hut or something. So, well, we got to create a diversion, so we shelled that and knocked it over. And the star shells fell down into all the scrub on this vacant hillside and set it all alight. And thought, well, we've created a diversion. We went back to Malta. And the next day, listening to the British broadcasts, we heard the British naval forces had attacked the German naval base and left it in flames. Alistair Campbell wasn't the first one to do spin. Anyhow, from Mari, again, I'm not sure the order of things, whether I went back to Rodney then, but at some time I went on to the cruiser Suffolk, which was mostly doing Arctic convoys through to Archangel. Do I repeat little incidents that are on that other tape? Yeah. Because I remember in Suffolk going into Archangel, which is a long, huge, wide estuary, and miles inland. And so we stopped at the entrance, and a Russian pilot boat came out, and a Russian pilot came aboard with a translator to see us into Archangel. And again, I'm just repeating the funny things one remembers. I remember looking out great to the shore on these hills, forested everywhere, covered in forest. And I remember seeing along the shore, in the distance this was, a black horse riding along the shore with somebody on it. And somebody turned to the Russian translator and said, "How far do those forests stretch?" "All the way to Vladivostok." 3,000 miles. And the other memory in Suffolk, and I can't remember which way round it was, either we were with a convoy going out to Archangel, or we were with a convoy from Archangel coming back. And unbeknownst to us, a convoy going the other way had been diverted because of the suspected or known presence of a German battle cruiser. And in the middle of the night, these two convoys ran head-on into each other. I don't know, 20 or 30 merchant ships, cruiser Suffolk, and four or five destroyers on each side. Absolute chaos, you know. So we'd gone to frantic action stations and everybody tearing around. I wouldn't say for one moment panic, but huge frenzied activity set in. And there were people on the bridge running to one voice pipe, shouting down, checking that, running to the other side, shouting on that voice pipe, coming back to answer that one, and people shouting the lookouts and lookouts over there, and everybody, you know, frenzied activity. And the gunnery officer turned to me and said, "Snotty, if I shout at you, will you shout back at me?" So put the thing into good proportion. And Suffolk. I think it must have been from Suffolk then that I went ashore to, was promoted to sub-lieutenant and went ashore to do my sub-lieutenant's courses.
Who had been the captain?
Pardon?
Who had been the captain of Suffolk?
I can't tell you. I can't tell you now. That's another thing about my senility. Oh. So, subs courses. We did navigation course, signals course, gunnery course, all those sort of things ashore, around. And then I was posted to the cruiser HMS Mauritius, colonial cruiser.
How rigorous have the courses been?
Oh, pretty, yes. And a torpedo course, yes. I mean, you really got your nose down and you worked hard at it. Yes, because, you know, you were very anxious, you were being marked on all this as to how you would pass and so on. And you wanted to do well in your naval career, and so you worked hard at it. Yes, and they were very intensive.
Mm. Had you volunteered to become an officer, or had you just been assigned?
It's just automatic. If you're a cadet at the Royal Naval College Dartmouth, it goes on and on and on. You know what I'm saying? I can't remember where all the courses were now. Some of them were in Plymouth. There was the Whale Island was the gunnery school, wasn't it? And there was a torpedo course. And we learnt a lot. Anyhow, as I say, I went on to HMS Mauritius as a sub-lieutenant. This time in charge of the gunroom. Oh dear, yes. And Mauritius. We did Atlantic convoys. And once again, we ended up in the Mediterranean. I seem to remember, too, doing a fast convoy with two, what we would now call cruise liners, I don't know, the Queen Elizabeth or something, you know, merchant vessels that were capable of 30 knots or whatever. And so we took them right round the Cape of Good Hope, round South Africa, up into the Indian Ocean. And I think or did we go back and into the Mediterranean back through Gibraltar? But having said that I wanted to fly, and having applied to the Admiralty for, you know, be taken off to do flying training, on the Mauritius, I was then said, right, you will now be the air defense officer. And so you will have to learn how to direct fighters if we're attacked from the air. And if we have air cover, you've got to communicate with them and keep it all alive. And we were in Dar es Salaam, and there was an aircraft carrier also in Dar es Salaam, part of the Indian Ocean Fleet. And I was seconded to the aircraft carrier for a week or two to learn, you know, aviation control and so on, fighter control. And again, this is irrelevant to the Navy, but the officer who was in charge of instructing me was a Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve officer called Michael Horton, who was a wonderful actor. And I, you know, got to know him after the war as working at the Old Vic and so on, because I went into the theatre there. And, you know, so it was a great privilege to have been instructed by Michael Horton. Anyhow, Mauritius.
What did that training involve for the air defence officer?
Being in radio contact and radar contact with any defence fighter screen sent to look after us, being in contact with them, and if necessary, because of our radar picking up any enemy aircraft, directing the fighters onto the enemy aircraft. And, you know, you had a plot table and you had to work very carefully at it. And we did exercises like that too with, you know, Summer or Catalina or... Oh God, what were the flying boats we used to have? What was the flying boat? We used to do exercise with that and direct fighters onto it anyhow. And I can't remember. And then in Mauritius, I know we were in the Mediterranean, but I can't remember if we went through the Suez Canal or right back round the south coast of South Africa and back through the Suez Canal. One thing I do remember, though, coming out of Alexandria Harbour in Egypt, no, into Alexandria Harbour, I think it was, or coming out, we ran aground. Oh, about 4 or 5 miles off the coast of Egypt, I think it was. And this was not a good thing, because that was within range of German aircraft from Crete, I suppose it would be, and Greece and so on. And even worse, there was a tanker also run aground half a mile away that had been bombed and was on fire. So we were really sort of a lit-up target overnight. But luckily the Germans didn't know anything anyhow. And the next day a tug came to tow us off. And that wasn't very good either. I remember we took a massive great wire hawser onto the port quarter of the Mauritius, round the stanchions, and the tug towed and towed, and we went full speed astern, and eventually we slid off, and there was this hawser. So the officer in charge, it wasn't me, thank goodness, this time, the officer in charge told the leading seaman to knock the shackles off the hawser, and he stepped forward and hit the hawser, and it came whistling off the stanchions, whipped back and broke his leg, which was not much fun. But really, from Mauritius, we spent a lot of time in Valletta, in Malta, and I was then eventually told, right, you've got your flying training course. And how did I get? I think I was flown back. Can't have been flown back over France, occupied by the Germans. No, it must have been, you know, one of the travel.
What sort of state had Malta been in?
I don't remember much about it, because we very seldom got ashore in Malta. But it was a hive of activity of, you know, convoys coming through, I mean, to support the army and who were in charge of Malta. Wait a minute. When did the British Army... Oh, yes, while I'm on the subject of Malta. Captain Beaky Armstrong, who'd been captain of the Mare, and quite rightly fled the U-boat, was in another destroyer in the Mediterranean with a convoy. One of the merchant ships in the convoy had been torpedoed by a U-boat. Beaky Armstrong stopped to pick up the British survivors from the merchant ship. It was torpedoed and sunk, and he was killed. Which is ironic in the extreme. No, I'm sure. Oh, yes, Mauritius. I haven't gone after this. This is before I go off on my flying training course. A lot of the convoys coming through, of course, were bringing military and supplies to invade Sicily. And we started, and the invasion of Sicily went ahead. And on the first day, one of the big plans was that airborne troops in gliders, towed by American fortress aircraft, I think it was a fortress, in American aircraft, were to be flown in and released so the gliders could land on the Sicilian coast, all around one particular bridge on the north-south highway on the east coast of Sicily, and take that bridge and cut off half the German army. Well, something went wrong, and only two gliders made it ashore, and the rest were slipped so far out at sea that they couldn't reach the shore, and they all came down in the sea. So we spent the first morning of the invasion of Sicily picking up British troops from the sea. Very angry British troops. And again, a little, not a personal, but a little vignette. The chief boatswain of HMS Mauritius was one Chief Petty Officer Dawson, who joined the Navy as a boy at 18, way back, served his time, being a Chief Petty Officer, retired, war broke out, call back. Chief Petty Officer Dawson, the boatswain. And he went over the side to help get the British soldiers out. And in the flurry and all doing all that, he lost his Pusser's dirk, his seaman's knife, which was engraved Boy Dawson. And he couldn't. Nothing else mattered to him then. You know, it was awful. He'd lost his Pusser's dirk. And then another incident in all that. We in HMS Mauritius were called in to bombard German positions. I forget the name of the town on the east coast of Sicily now. And there was a Dutch frigate with us, and we were hammering away at the German positions with our 6-inch guns, 12 6-inch guns, and one gun replied to us. I think it must have been a panzer tank or something, one didn't know. And one gun replied to it, and that gun hit the Dutch frigate, causing casualties and damage. And we couldn't see where this panzer tank was. We couldn't stop it. So what do we do? Turn and head out to sea. Cruiser with 12 6-inch guns and a Dutch frigate fleeing from one panzer tank. And we did go up. I followed up, because we were off Naples too. Anyhow, that's all I can really remember about Mauritius. And now I must have been put in some merchant ship and sent back to England, and eventually went off to do my flying training. And I continued with my flying, went to Canada for elementary and service flying training, back to the UK, and do a Spitfire Seafire conversion course. And completed my flying training on VJ Day, the day the Japanese surrendered. So that's the end of the war, and that's the end of this.